We cannot change that we're lonely at the moment, but we can change what we know about AI. And this gives us agency. This gives us agency to act upon and act upon our values and what is important for us in order to use these systems or to help others use these systems in not only efficient, but also safe and sustainable ways.
Welcome to Hello 5050 World, the podcast where we break tech bubbles before they break us and where we talk to people who make tech more humane. In this very first episode of the Hello 5050 World podcast, I had the pleasure to talk with Marisa Chop. Marisa is a psychologist, and she researches since years in the field of human-AI relationships and how we form trust to machines. What I personally found fascinating in this conversation is that we're also talking about what engineers and developers and designers of AI systems should take into account from a psychologist's perspective. We talk about the different ways people perceive AI and the influence of whether they're technical or not, on the way they trust an AI system. And we're also going to uncover whether AI should be used for mental health or not. Welcome, Marisa, to the Hello 5050 World podcast. We're very excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm happy to be here.
We're going to jump right in with the first question. So I'd like to know from you, how does your own path and your own life relate to making tech more humane?
Well, basically, it all started very early when I fell in love with R2-D2 and Star Wars. And I was wondering, oh, I also want this robot as my best friend. So I always kind of related to the idea of robots not being only tools, but being more than just tools. This is, I think, how it started in my childhood. However, I would have never expected to be working in this sphere. Yeah, up until, I don't know, I think it was 12 years ago when I was working in a total different sphere, in sports-related educational sphere. And I had a workshop from IBM, and they showed us the Watson and what it can do and how AI will change the world. And I was all back into my R2-D2 love and enthusiasm and was all excited about what's happening. And then what happened then was pretty unexpected, because when I looked around, the people in the room, they were all full of fear, skepticism, and they looked at me like, oh, what's going on? We don't need this. We don't want this. That was the point 12 years ago where I knew, oh, what's happening here? Such a bizarre fascination and fear. And this is where I decided, as a psychologist, I want to better understand how and why people react to robots and AI in the way they do.
When I asked you about making tech more humane and how this relates to your own life, the first thing you mentioned was robots. So how does robots or machines, how does it relate to psychology and the human mind in your perspective?
What fascinates me and keeps fascinating me for so many years now is that even though these robots are nothing more than bits and bolts, and there's nothing, there's no emotions, there's no soul, there's nothing behind it, it's no biology, there seems to be nothing we can do about that we still humanize them, that we still see more in them than just what it is, a tool. And this is what fascinates me in my personal life, the way I personally talk to, I don't know, my Google assistant, or the way I automatically say please and thank you to my digital assistants or the LLM chatbots or whatever it is, or the way my kids interact, for instance, with those chatbots. I keep seeing this with fascination, but also with some sort of a little bit of fear, because then what I've seen in my work is much more risky, much more dangerous, with many more implications that I've ever thought of in my rather optimistic way of seeing life, in my way also as a psychologist. I always believe in the good and the best of the humans, no matter on which side you stand. And it was a bit awakening for me to see well, the many darker sides we have encountered in the past or in the past decade when we talk about human AI or human robot interaction. Maybe also a little bit a disclaimer here, when I do say robot, but my research is really on AI chatbots and communicative systems, so I don't really look at robots themselves. I've also done some research with them, but usually I look at disembodied AI and how people perceive them. And yet we talk about robots in some sort of embodied way. It happens sort of naturally sometimes.
I work in engineering, and a lot of my colleagues, they actually talk to AI as if it's a machine much more. So prompt engineering is actually much more logical and structured. On the other hand, you have a lot of people talking to AI as if it's a friend. So how do you see this? And in your research, is this something that is also impacting the emotional connection to the AI?
Yes, I mean, so there are a lot of interrelated topics here. So the one thing you mentioned is, who are the people who are talking to a system? And now with system, I mean either robots or chatbots, but it has to be something that talks back to us in some natural language. So this is kind of what makes a huge difference. The moment we see an artifact, we have a huge tendency to anthropomorphize it, to humanize it. So I would like to spend some time on this topic a little bit, because it's basically the basis of what we're talking about, or the theoretical basis of why we even treat robots, AI, or systems in a way differently than I treat my toaster or my coffee machine. So historically, I mean, it kind of starts with, you know, calling a system intelligent. So usually intelligence is something that has been more associated with humans or animals when we talk about cognitive structures or machines being able to do tasks that usually smart people or smarter animals can do. And this is where kind of this humanization or these humanizing tendencies started. And that triggers a mechanism in our brains that has been there for centuries, right? So we have a tendency to anthropomorphize artifacts. So, I mean, we know this in our current lives. For instance, when we, you know, when we say thank you to our cars when after a long ride, or when we're sad that our Tamagotchi died, it helps us in many ways. It helps us to understand things better. And it also helps us, for instance, when we have an increased need for social contact. So it has been shown that, for instance, people who are more lonely are even more prone to humanize these systems or animals like dogs. But these studies started with women, for instance, falling in love or having very intense relationships with their DVD players. So this very innate structure we have in our brains, this is like, you can see this maybe as a lens or glasses as how we walk through this world and try to make sense of it. We want to understand or estimate what this artifact, this other, is doing now. What is its next step? And in order to understand that, if we don't have the background, if we don't have the understanding of the system, we make use of what we already know, the heuristics we have in our brain. And what we know is what we are used from human interactions. And since these systems often appear human-like, they talk to us like humans, they are smarter than our toaster, they take over tasks that humans can do, that triggers that mechanisms. And then what we do is we use the social scripts that we are used from our human interactions, from a human to human interactions, the social scripts like saying hi, saying thank you, being nice to each other, or being mad at each other for stuff. We use these scripts and we translate them into human AI interaction. And here, as I mentioned, being knowledgeable about what the system actually is, because you talked about the engineers, you talked about prompt engineering, etc., that may make a huge difference in the way we humanize these systems and thus how we interact with them, how that influences our behavior, our decisions, and so on.
You touched on these social scripts. I would like to stay for a moment on that. Can you make an example of such a like a psychological phenomena that is then put into a social script, because I think, especially with AI now using natural language, it talks to us as another human, but it also uses these social scripts that you call them. Can you make an example of that and how we could also notice that when we interact with AI?
Basically, what you can do, or what we are doing, is we can take any psychological theory that has been tested and validated in psychology and put that into human AI interaction. So trust is an example. Pro-social behavior is an example. We help other people. Do we also help other robots? And then we look at, are we translating these psychological process also into human AI interaction? And if so, in which ways? Falling in love with a system, with a robot. This is also something that, a script, so to speak, that has been translated into human AI interaction. And in my field, it's social relationships. So what I have done is we've taken relationships, a theory from psychology, and we wanted to know, do people experience their relationship to systems, to AI systems, in the same way as they do with other humans? So these are some examples of how these scripts are now investigated in human AI interaction.
I'm going to give the question back to you. So what did you find out in your research? Is that, are we already there? Are we moving towards such a future, or what's happening in the research field?
Well, yeah, we're right in there. It's no future music. It's no science fiction. It's there. Just yesterday, again, there was a nice report from a German media psychologist. They interviewed someone who is in a relationship with a chatbot, a loving relationship, a loving friendship, maybe even more. And so these instances are real. They're happening now. We do not know exactly the scale of it when we look at these more, let's say, I'm going to call it a little bit the extreme cases. Now, the way I look at it from an academic or from a research perspective is that there are different ways of looking at relationships. And the way we investigate it is that they are multidimensional. So when I have an AI chatbot, and it doesn't matter if it's marketed to me as a friend or as a digital assistant. We'll put that aside. What I'm looking at is the perception of how I see it, independent of it. So what could be is that I have ChatGPT, which was supposed to be functional and, you know, just about efficiency and, you know, making work more efficient, and I'm making my writing better, etc. But what happens then is that people actually see it as a friend or as a sparring partner or as a co-pilot whatsoever. So they are finding their own ways in interpreting their relationship to these systems. And they can also vary depending on the tasks. So sometimes I see these systems more as tool, more as a servant, when it comes to, for instance, turning on the light. But when it comes to speaking about an issue I have with my boss, then I'm changing my behavior with these systems. And that's the same thing we're doing in human-to-human interactions. So we investigated a few thousand conversational AI users, for instance, Alexa, Google Assistant, and so on. And we found that they see these systems in three different ways. So the one is more the master-servant perspective. So most of the people see these systems as their servants to give orders to. So there's a hierarchy between those two. Then something that we're also not surprised to see is that there are people who see their Alexas, their Google Assistants, more as a friend. So they're more equal to each other. It's more emotional. There's more, you know, these notions of trust. And they highly anthropomorphize these systems. They highly humanize them. And then we found a third perspective that was equally interesting, which we called the rational agent perspective. So when people see these systems on this third rational agent perspective, they see these systems not below them as these tools, but also not emotional as a friend, but as a rational agent, but on eye level. So something that has more or less the same agency as they are, right? And at that time, that was pretty interesting because if you look how companies market the AI systems now, they're not digital assistants anymore, right? They're now our co-pilots. They are now our companions, our peers, our sparring partners. So the way they market their systems now, which are supposedly, quotation marks, smarter and better and, you know, can give you much more than the older systems, is very interesting now and coincides with what we found. And it's interesting because next time, you know, just think about it, right? If you make a decision in your workplace and your assistant is now not, you know, your servant anymore, but it's now your co-pilot on eye level, you know, how does that affect you, the way you make a decision? Very likely it does, right? I mean, if you think about it, it can't change the dynamics. And this is something we have to be very aware of.
Do you have any recommendations from your research, because you analyzed so many conversations, for people that are building these AI systems in general, not just a companion, how they can look out or put guardrails into place?
There are good laws and good ethical guidelines we can already adhere to, and every company could just go and look up what they should or have to do, meaning age control mechanisms, safety mechanisms in terms of cybersecurity to prevent breaches, etc. Then, of course, there are all kinds of things that are changing now, like reminding the people that this is always a robot and never a human, telling people, reminding them to shut the system down, or classical guardrails in terms of when somebody starts talking about suicide or self-harm or harming others, that how especially those LLM chatbots react, and so on. And then, of course, there are laws like that you never are able to, that you're not allowed to, for instance, pretend you're human when you're not. Now, since especially in Europe, we have quite good guidelines and laws that we could adhere to. The problem is that usually these things happen in retrospect. So the American approach is move fast and break things. So they put these things on the market, semi-tested or not really safe, and people try it out, use it, and they just look what happens, and then they fix it on the go. If things happen, they fix it on the go. So that's the classic Wild Wild West scenario. And this is unfortunately sad because things have happened and they are bad and the companies get sued for it. They pay their millions. But the question is, what changes? What changes, right? I mean, this is the big question. Yet, of course, companies must be held accountable, etc. So from a designer's perspective, I mean, there's many things we can do. But the question is, what is being done?
One big challenge is the testing of these AI tools. Because traditionally in software, testing is like you can predict what the system should be doing, and then you can test it and see whether it actually gives the intended result or not. And a test fails if it doesn't give you the right result. With AI systems, it's not deterministic, so it's not, you cannot predict what the outcome will be. And sometimes even every time you test, you get a different result. So I also feel in the industry, there's currently, I'd say, people have to learn how to actually functionally test these tools. And I'm wondering if you already have seen certain like use cases or examples of companies that have found good ways, or if this is also something that is a almost like a research field where the whole industry of developing AI tools needs to kind of step up and learn how to do this properly.
So I think the most interesting thing we're seeing in from our company perspective in cybersecurity is that the people are not coming. So that means they are now more on the operating level. So this is an interesting market change we're seeing here, because beforehand it seemed to be more internal. People were not really talking about it. We're fearful to put these things out for good reasons. So yes, we can and we should and we are doing great testing procedures, but however, this will develop and it's not fixed yet, right? Now, the problem, as you already mentioned, with non-deterministic programs is that they're not deterministic, so there will always be uncertainty I mean, as with every system, right? I mean, no computer is perfect now, so we should not assume that not AI systems are working perfect, right? We can still break the software, we can still break the hardware, et cetera, and social engineer people to do things. So there's always a way to break a system. But LLMs specifically are extremely vulnerable and unsafe, especially in highly critical contexts. So from my perspective, especially for instance in mental health, I totally advising completely 100% against using LLMs in the mental health field and also in research. I mean, that's not only a technical question, it's also an ethical decision, right? I don't want to support this. Hence, I also do not do the research on it at the moment. Maybe things will change. However, I don't see for now how we will be able to stop or to change that systems don't hallucinate anymore or give exposure to content they shouldn't do. So long story short, so for instance, how I deal with it is, well, then I do it with systems that are not AI systems. So I use chatbots that are rule-based, that are clickbots, etc., etc. People still think it's AI. They don't really discover the difference. And yet I make sure that my participants in my studies, that they are safe. And the same I would do with clients with who are dealing with this or who want to try out these systems for their mental health, let's say, for instance, in their companies or so on. So then I try to promote wherever possible the safest systems.
How do you see these interaction patterns evolving in the AI space? Like, are we going to move on from the chatbots at some point? Do you think it would be beneficial? Or is that going to be the main way that we will interact with AI also in the future? I'll give you an example here from myself. So I think 2-3 years ago, my company, they created a support agent or a chatbot. You could file a support case or a ticket. And I tested it and I kind of was just chatting with it. And my intent was to figure out whether I should file a support ticket, not necessarily that a ticket is filed right away. This was in the early days. And the problem with this was I was writing my first message and it immediately created a ticket, which was not my intent. And then it created overhead for the support team. And I also immediately lost trust to this support agent because it did something that was not expected. Of course, now, 3 years later, we have much more sophisticated interaction patterns. Often the agents, they first ask for confirmation before they do something. They don't just act on our behalfs. So these kind of patterns, how do you see those evolving also from a psychological perspective? How do they help with these human AI interaction?
So since you mentioned the word of trust or the term trust, I think because this is something I've been looking at a lot over the past decade. So I think you kind of described a very classic trust trajectory. And now you are an expert, keep this in mind. And many people use these systems who are not experts. So, but generally speaking, I think these trajectories may be similar. So for instance, so there's something somewhat sold to you or, you know, you hear or whatever reason, or you wanted to build these agents because, you know, AI is cool and LLMs are super and, you know, we all want to work less and be more at the body or on the lake. So there's first this enthusiasm, there's some sort of overtrust maybe a little bit. So there's also some, you know, These systems are marketed to you as a way that they are beneficial. I mean, other than not, you would have not chosen this way or this agent or whatsoever to use it. So you have high expectations usually. And this is the classic AI hype industry. You know, they always create expectations that are way beyond, usually, I call that the Muskian marketing strategy, right? We're self-driving cars everywhere and so on. So it's like, it's not. But anyways, so this creates this starting pattern of usually, you know, be having high expectations and so on. So and then usually what happens is you realize, usually you get to the point, right? It depends. Sometimes if you're not very knowledgeable or so, or, you know, or you're lucky, then you get an answer that, oh my God, that's so good. And then, you know, other things happen. But in your case, you realized, oh, the performance is not as good as I have expected it. So in performance is one of the the great factors of evaluating the trustworthiness of a system. Performance is one factor. Integrity is the other one. So understanding how the system works, how it comes to the decision it makes. And the third one is benevolence. So is this system, you know, why does the system do what it does, right? So you want to know, is that, is the system working for me, or is it actually, you know, gathering data for the company, and so on. But performance is the classic factor where people calibrate their trust in the system. So it influences your level of trust, and the way you trust a system then influences how you rely on it, the way you use it, right? So, and this trust calibration process is working ideally, or you have a good calibration if your level of trust is, you know, in one line, so to speak, with its performance. So that if you overtrust it, then you trust it more than its performance, but you also don't want to undertrust it, right? This is also a bad calibration, because we want to make use of the system, and, you know, we want to use it so that it helps us. But if you don't trust it and don't use it and underestimate its performance, then you also have a badly calibrated trust. So this is why it is so important to understand the performance of a system. What can it actually do to calibrate your level of trust and use it in the best way? And with best, I mean, you know, efficiently, sustainably, safely. So these are then, this is one of the greatest factors. And this is how it works, right? And you also see that trust is a dynamic, a time-relevant attitude or a factor. So it changes, right? And also the performance of systems change. So also it's something that happens over time. It's not something that you create once and it stays the way, right?
As you said, I think with these AI systems, they've gotten much better with the performance. So that's what I noticed. If you used it 2 years ago and now, there's a huge difference. Where do you also see, in terms of the future, where we're going, where do you also see hope or things that are going in the right direction from your perspective?
I want to just again bring in two perspectives. Again, it's very, so you're very technical. You would go in there with a very different approach. People with a non-technical background look at these things differently. They only look at the outside. They basically know nothing, right? So they ask ChatGPT a question, a somewhat logical answer comes out there, and they, even if it's wrong, they cannot evaluate whether it's right or wrong, or they think it's right. So it's somewhat, so we always have to a little bit differentiate who is looking at that. And in fact, we've also done that in a recent study where we looked at non-tech people and tech experts and the way they anthropomorphize these systems. And the way us so humanize these systems, right? So coming back to the very beginning, why is this important? Because trust is a very anthropomorphic concept. So there's no trust without anthropomorphism, basically, in lay words. So they're highly related. The more you humanize, the more this concept of trust is surfacing. So, and what we've seen is that people with more knowledge about the technology, they anthropomorphize less. And for both groups, the way they humanize the system influences their intention to use it. That's the one thing. And then it also, for instance, influences more care for the system. So they care for the system and they humanize. They did not want to shut it off, right? It was something they feel not good about, right? So what I'm trying to say is, from your question and also what we found in our study, is that being knowledgeable about these things might at the moment be our greatest weapon, so to speak, against manipulation, against exploitation, against misuse, against overtrust, against biases, meaning automation biases is where we think the automation works perfect always, right? So I think, and this is a message I kind of, you know, want to not end with, but is because this is something we can change, right? We cannot change personality factors. We cannot change that we're lonely at the moment. But we can change what we know about AI. And this gives us agency. This gives us agency to act upon and act upon our values and what is important for us in order to use these systems or to help others use these systems in not only efficient, but also safe and sustainable ways.
All right, let's jump into a round of rapid fire questions for you. The first one is, if you could rewrite any line of code in any product, what would you do? What would it be?
I think I would change the LinkedIn algorithm to, you know, not promoting rage and people being all mad about stuff and selling stuff to, you know, giving the same kind of voices to people who are maybe more quiet, who have the expertise to put things into place, but do not get the same amount of attention as the very loud and rage bait people.
Fully agree. I would support that. All right. Next one is, what is an everyday act of allyship that anyone can do? Maybe also in the context of human AI.
Or maybe the first act of allyship would be listen first. And why is this so important? In the field of human AI relationships, especially when people have friends or are in love with such a system, they get stigmatized very easily. People find it weird, awkward, and then they hide even more. And that does not help us create a good society. So before you judge, listen first who they are, why they do what they do, and try to understand.
And then the last one is, whose voices do you think people in tech should hear more of?
Well, of course, I'm a bit biased here, but obviously psychologists and critical AI studies. Why is that so? What I've seen in the past is that we not only need people to show you what we need, what we want, or what should be, which is important, but as psychologists, we have the major task or opportunity to actually show how it is at the moment. So really showing, bridging that gap between what is with the people in human AI and what should be, and putting these people together, I think would help to understand these situations in a good way, and, you know, and understand and create technologies, a world with technologies where we benefit from these technologies.
Yeah, it's also something that I think we'll be seeing more, that tech companies actually hire psychologists to understand how these AI systems influence people. I definitely agree that that might not happen or should happen, actually, yeah, as you mentioned. And then to wrap everything up, if the listeners remember just one thing from this episode, what should it be?
Well, I think it should be that we should be well aware of that AI is no tool anymore. It's part of our infrastructure. It's part of our social, of our daily lives. And that people do develop some sort of relationship with these systems. We do not exactly know how and why and how it looks like and how emotional or how functional it is. But what we can expect is that the way people view their relationship to AI will influence how we make decisions and our behavior.
Thank you so much, Marisa, for this interesting talk, and wish you all the best in the future and keep on researching in this area. It's really needed. And yeah, we're very happy that you shared with us today. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in today. You were listening to the Hello 5050 World podcast. More episodes are going to come soon. If you have people in your environment that should be listening to these conversations, please forward them and share your own perspective on this topic in the comments. We're looking forward to hearing from you. And if you have ideas for future podcast topics, let us know.